When we look at the world around us, we see a vibrant abundance of life. Information from our senses tells us all about a world of extraordinary beauty and complexity. But what if there was some reason to call into doubt our sensory experience? Can we really know for certain that such a world exists? Or is everything we see, feel, smell, taste, and hear just the result of a trick of the mind? Welcome to Wonderland. In the next half an hour, we are going to show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. I'm Rob, and he's Ed, and you're listening to The Thirst. Enjoy responsibly. Ed, how are you feeling today? You're looking a bit green round the gills. I know you had a bit of a late night last night.
Yeah, well, I was... Do you remember we discussed about the thought experiment last episode, where you go to the fridge and take a can of naughty juice?
Yeah.
Let's just say I carried out a practical experiment yesterday, and several cans of naughty juice do affect your mind. So the good news is we've dealt with that. I know listeners were worried about that, so that's done. I'd like, in a change of events, for you to actually start today, if that's all right, Rob.
Yeah, I can see you're looking a bit tired. I think I need to take some of the weight.
Yeah, that's fine. We're actually going to be starting with The Matrix. I know that might be surprising
film.
To you. Yeah, what exactly. What a film. Aside from it being a great film, it does raise some interesting philosophical issues. I suppose we should just give a brief summary of the film for those of our listeners who are too old or too young to have enjoyed it.
Okay, for those of you unfamiliar with the storyline, the main character, whose name is Neo, basically finds out that his whole life up until now has been a computer simulation, which is called The Matrix. So in the beginning of the film, we see him going about his everyday normal life, working 9 to 5, as we're all well accustomed to.
Of course.
And living for weekends, where, you know, he sits at home and hacks computers.
Mm-hmm.
But we learn as the film goes on, in reality, all this time, Neo's body has been chilling out in a vat of fluid, with his brain wired up to a massive computer.
Nice.
So in his mind, he lives out his life in this simulation, going about his everyday life, with the computer feeding him his sensations and his perceptions. He's hooked up to the Matrix in such a way that every time he decides to get up and walk around, the simulation changes so that, for him, it appears as if he's stood up and is walking around. It looks to Neo as though he is on Earth in New York in the year 1999, where in the real world, he's in a hole somewhere halfway to hell in the year closer to 2199. At a crucial point during the film, Neo is made aware of this fact, and then stuff gets real. So that's it in a nutshell, aside from, you know, mega kung fu and serious...
Yeah, I was going to say, we've sort of made it sound quite boring, where really it's not. But yeah, interesting story I've got about The Matrix, Rob.
Go ahead then.
It came out on DVD when I think I was 14.
Right.
And I was around a friend's house and we were all very excited about watching it.
I can imagine, yeah.
Because we'd heard a big fuss had been made. Nobody had any idea what it was about. Well, we certainly didn't. Incidentally, we have just ruined it for anyone who is listening.
Yeah, we really should have said spoiler alert.
Well, the spoiler alert, guys. So if you want to try and forget what you've just heard, then that's fine. If not, then we're sorry. But anyway, I was around my friend's house, and his mum decided that since we were all underage, so to speak, she should ring our respective mothers and get permission, which is always a bad idea with my mum. So everybody's mum said it was fine, apart from mine. But instead of sparing me the humiliation and just saying we can't watch it because somebody's mum has said no, she let us watch it anyway. But then blamed my mother and said everyone's mum was fine with it apart from Ed's. So not only did I have to lie to my mother and pretend we hadn't watched it, but I got the humiliation from my friends, from my peers, my respected fellows. So me and The Matrix didn't get off on the right foot, and then of course I didn't understand a second of it anyway, so it wouldn't have made
any difference.
Yeah,
it's quite confusing. I remember when I watched it for the first time when I was probably the same age, and I was like, what is going on here?
Yeah.
But one aspect that I did find really cool is at one point in the film, Trinity, which is another one of the characters, which is, you know, an accomplice of Neo, needs to fly a helicopter.
Mm.
And because she's in the Matrix at the time, someone from outside the Matrix can just download it to her. And, you know, that's that. She's able to do it. So I was just going to put a question to you, Ed.
Mm.
If you could have any program downloaded into you, what would it be?
It's a tricky one. It's a tricky one, Rob. I've always...
And you can't say anything, you know, a nightmare like the ability to download
I wasn't going to say yourself, that. Of course, yeah. I was going to say that. Okay, that aside, it would probably be something to do with languages. While it would be cool to have into Kung Fu,
that's pretty cool, actually.
It would also be quite cool to be able to speak every single language, and you could just go around the world romancing women in the language of love. but for those of you that have seen the film, I think arguably you'd have to have an hour with the woman in the red dress.
Ah, I can only agree. That aside, we could spend ages contemplating the possibilities of that program. But
well, what would you do? You put me on the spot here. Do you have anything up your sleeve?
I'd go along the superpower route. So you have the one. You know, you can either be a mutant or from a different planet and have a superpower, or in the Matrix, you could have it downloaded to you. So you could easily have super strength or fly or something like that. So I'd probably have one of those.
Well, there we go. You're the brute and I'm the gentleman.
Brawn and brains.
Yeah.
Again.
Exactly. Let's leave the Matrix to one side for now. Just wanted you to speak, to be honest with you. And I thought you could speak about the Matrix better than you could about Descartes. But
it's debatable.
Apart from being a splendid film, the Matrix should be commended for making famous in the public's mind an important philosophical problem called external world skepticism. The external world is what philosophers call the world beyond the mind, and skepticism in one sense is a method of applying doubt to beliefs. So external world skepticism concerns our knowledge about the external world, including whether or not we can know if a world outside our minds even exists. So the most famous exemplification of external world skepticism appears in the first of Descartes' six meditations. In fact, the Matrix borrows a lot from Descartes' philosophies, not least the distinction between mind and body that we discussed last week. The meditations is a search for certainty. And in it, Descartes reasons that in order to find a piece of certain knowledge, he'll have to dispose of everything he currently believes in and start again from scratch. So he therefore begins his project by casting into doubt all of his beliefs in order to find out what remains, if anything. Now, typically our beliefs are founded on the information we receive via the senses. So we have certain perceptions of the world around us, this stick, that stick, etc. And we infer on the basis of those perceptions that there must be something out there, an external world, with objects that are distinct from our perceptions of them. Descartes wants to call the sensorial method into question. He has various methods for doubting his beliefs, the most extreme of which involves invoking the concept of an evil demon. The idea is that we can't know that we're not the plaything of an omnipotent and malicious being who makes us live out our lives under a veil of illusion, constantly tricking us into believing things that are false. So for example, our listeners may think they're sitting here listening to our podcast. They think this on the basis of evidence from their senses. So they can look at our iTunes logo, they can hear our voices, and they can probably
click and rate us 5 stars.
Yeah, click and rate us 5 stars and feel themselves falling in love with our voices. Descartes' concern is that there's no way of telling for sure if there's no way for our listeners to tell for sure if they are in fact sitting there listening to a podcast. Perhaps an evil demon is making them think that they are. So this rules out everything beyond the mind. It might be shocking for our listeners to hear, but me and you might not actually exist. As far as they're concerned, it could all be a trick of their mind, which is probably devastating to the legions of fans out there.
It's devastating to me, Ed. Let alone the listeners.
Oh, dear. The modern example of this kind of skepticism is called the brain in the vat hypothesis. So the idea is that you might just be a brain in a vat being fed all of your sensations so that it appears to you as if you were living the dream in an external world, which is the same idea we discussed earlier with regards to the Matrix. You can't know whether or not you're plugged in, so to speak. Now, it looks to be the case that if you are a brain in the vat, then all of your beliefs about the world are most likely false. For example, if you are a brain in the vat, then you aren't really sitting here listening to this podcast as you believe you are. You're a brain in a vat thinking you're sitting here listening to this podcast.
Yeah, it's a crucial distinction, isn't it?
Exactly. So the problem is that skeptical scenarios are constructed in such a way you can't know whether you're in them or not. And this means that since you can't know if you're a brain in a vat, you can't know any of the beliefs about the world you typically take yourself to know. So external world skepticism works by taking any one of our ordinary beliefs about the world and finding a reason to doubt it by introducing a skeptical hypothesis.
I take your point that it is very easy to fool your your brain and your mind if they are one and the same thing.
Oh, wow. Someone's been listening.
Yeah, well, fooling your eyes is easy with an optical illusion or something like that. But yeah, if we are all in a program or plugged into a brain in a vat, as you were, surely that would be part of the programming. So an optical illusion looks like an optical illusion just because of the programming.
That's a good point. That's how Descartes starts his Project of Doubt.
Great minds think alike, Ed.
I'm not sure about that, Rob. Fools seldom differ. But yeah, basically Descartes starts by saying, well, sometimes his senses have failed him in the past. So he looked at a stick in water and it looked like it was bent. And we know it's not, because if you took it out, it would be whole. And we know that's a trick of the light, but he starts from the particular instances of his senses fooling him to a more general problem where he thinks, well, maybe I'm dreaming all of the time. And then he jacks the...
Not the dream thing.
The dreaming thing.
And at the end, it was all a dream.
It's he doesn't go down there, does he? How Harry Potter should have ended. That would have been so good. Can you imagine the devastation? The raw devastation in the fans' eyes. If she'd done that, would have been fantastic. But yeah, and then he jacks up the standard of doubt one more notch, as if he's not doubting everything enough already. He introduces the evil demon, which allows him to doubt all of his perceptual beliefs all of the time. Now, when we spoke about this issue earlier, Rob, you took a sort of who cares approach. And I'd like to ask you now, if that's all right, whether you'd rather live in a fantasy or reality. So let's return to The Matrix.
Okay.
Now, there's a point in the film, after Neo has been told that his life up until now has all been a sham, that he's offered a choice between a blue pill and a red pill. Now, the blue pill would allow him to remain in the Matrix, having forgotten all that he'd been told, while the red pill would allow him to escape into the real world. My question to you, Rob, is which pill would you take?
Red pill. Every time.
Well, you want the real world.
I want the real world.
You want the real experience.
Yeah.
Well, then, bearing that in mind, I think I would too. I think most people would choose knowledge of the truth, no matter how uncomfortable, over blissful ignorance. And this shows that human beings need to know things. Mm. We need to know, above all else, that there is an external world. So your shrugging your shoulders and saying who cares doesn't seem to be a fair response, a fair attitude in someone that would take the red pill.
Well, at least if someone offered you the red pill, you'd know for sure that, you know, you'd exist. And you were a brain in the vat. Imagine, you know, finding out that someone else had the opportunity to have the red pill and you were yourself a simulation. That would mess you up.
That would be a nightmare. Well, Rob, you've completely accidentally stumbled on Descartes' very point. Very neat, actually. So, basically, where we're left at the end of the first meditation is we can't know that whether or not we're the plaything of an evil demon. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we can't know whether there's an external world. Therefore, we can't know any of the beliefs about the world that we typically take ourselves to know. So how did Descartes respond to the problem? Like I said before, the introduction of the evil demon allows Descartes to doubt all of the evidence from his senses all of the time. You just can't rule out the possibility that everything is an illusion. Yet one thing remains. It's impossible for him not to exist, even if he is a brain in the vat. So, in a dramatic turn of events, Descartes finds that all of the skeptical hypotheses actually imply his existence. This is because even if he's being deceived about the external world, he is still being deceived, and therefore he must exist in some form. And this works for each of us. We can all say that for as long as we are being deceived, for as long as we are doubting that the external world exists, we must exist, because there must be something that is being deceived. There must be something to do with the doubting. This leads Descartes to his cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, which is one of the most famous proofs in the history of philosophy. Now, do you remember last time, Rob, that I hinted at some of Descartes' arguments for the distinction between mind and body, but I wasn't going to go into too much detail because we were going to discuss it today.
Vaguely, yeah.
Carry it's on. good to hear that you are listening, Rob. That's always nice. Anyway, for those of you who were listening, it's the cogito that allows Descartes to make his distinction between the mind and the body, because, as you've just heard,
You can doubt your body, but you cannot doubt that you exist. And for Descartes, that means that you can doubt your body, but you cannot doubt your mind exists. And if you can doubt one and not the other, they must therefore be distinct things, according to Mr. Descartes.
I've still got a problem though, Ed, because surely if we've been created by this external person, super intelligent...
The malicious
exactly, demon. Yeah, the demon. Mm. Surely he has created you that way to think like that anyway. So the way that you think has already been, you know, predetermined by this person.
That's right. I think that's a good point. I think what the Cogito shows is that you must exist in some form or other, because even if you're a brain in a vat, or even if, yeah, or not a brain in the vat, for as long as you're freaking out about the external world to get to, as long as you're doubting, as long as you're thinking you're being deceived, you must be something, namely the thing that is doubting or thinking it's being deceived.
So you're saying
that
that's enough for reality?
Yeah, that's quite a crass response that I would never actually say myself. But I think let's leave it that the Cogito establishes your existence, the nature of which is to be decided. But we know you're the sort of thing that doubts and the sort of thing that thinks. Now, you might say that, sure, you can be certain of your own existence, but what about the existence of everything else? What about the existence of the external world? And what about the existence of other minds? Fairly weighty topics that Descartes hasn't dealt with yet. So in response to the skepticism that he introduced in the first meditation, Descartes argues in the second and the sixth that we can move from the particular certainty of the cogito to a more general kind of certainty about the existence of other things. He starts by asking himself, how do I know I exist? In other words, how did I come by the cogito? He reasons that he knows he exists because he clearly and distinctly perceives that he does. He then moves from it. Go on.
If you perceive that you are, then surely that's just observing that you are. And we all know, we established earlier, that you can be fooled easily by your senses.
Rob, you're absolutely on fire today. I was hoping you wouldn't pick me up on that. Basically, when Descartes talks about...
I'm actually listening. I slightly understand this topic, so I can...
This is good.
In.
This is exciting. Basically, when Descartes says clearly and distinctly perceive, he's not talking about the sort of perception we would talk about when we look around us.
Right.
I can't remember his exact terminology, which is why I wasn't going to elaborate. But basically, in his epistemology, a clear and distinct perception is something that we're entitled to know for sure. Think of it as like a clear and distinct idea rather than perception. We'll call it an idea.
Okay.
So as we discussed last episode, remember Descartes' epistemology is all about thinking pretty hard about the way you think the world is and then coming to those conclusions. So a clear and distinct idea for Descartes is something that he thinks he's entitled to know for sure. So he moves from a particular instance of clear and distinct ideas, i.e. the cogito, to the broad claim that anything he clearly and distinctly perceives must be true. Crucially, God is one of Descartes' clear and distinct ideas. Now, God is not going to be a naughty boy, so he won't allow us to be deceived all the time. So in Descartes' terminology, God ensures that everything we clearly and distinctly perceive, i.e. that there is an external world, must be true. It's fair to say that Descartes' skeptical scenarios have been taken more seriously over the years than his resolution of them. There are many problems with his reasoning. Anybody seeking for more information needs only type Cartesian circle into Google for a blow-by-blow account of his folly. Without going into too much detail, it looks as if he isn't entitled to use God as a guarantee for the security of his clear and distinct perceptions, because his clear and distinct perceptions were used to prove the existence of God in the first place. I'm assuming, Rob, that in any case you don't want to introduce God by means of solving our skeptical worries.
I'd rather not, no.
Okay, well, with that in mind, let's leave Descartes' argument to one side and move on to another more serious response. All right, so like I said earlier, skeptical scenarios are constructed in such a way that we cannot tell whether or not we're in them. This means you can't appeal to any evidence by means of proving that you're not a brain in a vat. So how on earth can we resist the skeptical conclusion that since we don't know whether or not we're a brain in the vat, we also can't know anything about the external world? The response we're going to be looking at today was made by English philosopher G.E. Moore. In his Proof of an External World, which he wrote in 1939, Moore argued, here is one hand, here is another hand. If these if these are hands and there is an external world, because hands are physical mind independent objects, therefore there is an external world, and skepticism is refuted.
Does that mean that Moore is believing dualism because he believes his mind and body are separate things and his body is part of this external world, whereas his mind is different?
When I say mind independent, I mean you can say brain independent. Objects that exist outside of your imagination.
Okay.
So on first glance, it looks as though Moore has completely missed the point. I always used to think of it as pub philosophy at its best. So it's like some skeptics have been having a conversation at the table and then Moore's leered over drunkenly and said, "What are you talking about? Of course I know I've got hands. There's one here." I think it would be... They say Joey Barton does philosophy. I think that if Joey Barton was running these days, this is exactly what he'd have said. But if we look closer, I think that there may actually be some merit to Moore's approach. So let's do some background work. I know you love it, so mm-hmm. why not?
A bit of background.
Rude really. Not to. in philosophy, there are various forms of valid arguments, which we've been using in all the episodes. I just haven't pointed them out yet.
Mm-hmm.
As we found in episode 2, essentially an argument is valid if the conclusion follows logically from the premises in such a way that if the premises are true, the conclusion is also true.
I remember that.
Good. I was hoping this would be a refresher course. Skeptical arguments that we've been considering so far take the form of an argument that's called modus ponens. That's right. We're so cool in philosophy that we give our arguments Latin names.
Well, science is the same thing.
Yeah, of course. You
know, species and things like that. People of course. Love it.
Why not? Anyway, modus ponens is the method of forward inference. So it goes as follows. If P implies Q and P is true, then Q is also true. So a skeptical argument might go something like this. If I don't know whether there is an external world, then I don't know whether or not I have hands. I don't know whether or not there's an external world, because I might be a brain in the vat, etc. Yeah. Therefore, I don't know whether or not I have hands. Now, this is a perfectly valid form of reasoning, but Moore's point is there's another way to argue. He uses a type of argument called modus tollens, which goes as follows. If P implies Q and Q is false, then P is also false. So his argument with regards to the external world might look like this. If I don't know whether there's an external world, then I don't know whether or not I have hands. I know I have hands, therefore I know that there is an external world. Moore's point is that if you have an inference, you don't always have to argue forwards. You can argue backwards as well.
I think I understand, but have you got another example for a simpleton like me?
I have got another example.
Always prepared.
It's an example I borrowed from a lecture in general philosophy given by Peter Milliken, who's an Oxford professor whose podcast I've listened to on many a pensive autumn night. So in the Bible, in chapter 20 of Deuteronomy, the Jews are commanded to annihilate six nations of people whose only apparent sin is that they're living in the lands promised to the Jews by God. So the Jews are told to save alive nothing that breathes and utterly destroy them. Not only the
what my rugby coach usually says before I go out and play a game.
Yeah, of course. But when you play rugby, you play against 15 men. I hope you don't then go back and kill their children. Because in this particular example, the Jews are instructed not only to kill the warriors, but the women and children too. Now, a religious fundamentalist might argue that everything in the Bible is true, therefore genocide is sometimes desirable. But somebody more rational may equally argue that genocide is never desirable, and therefore not everything in the Bible is true. So this shows that when we consider philosophical problems, we don't have to start with a given implication and move forwards. Sometimes we should take a look at where that implication leads us and rethink our commitment to it. So the question is, which of those two starting premises should I hold more dear? That everything in the Bible is true, or that genocide is never desirable? Clearly, for me, the latter has more to commend it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you would hope that the rational Christian, although they may have started out with the hypothesis that everything in the Bible is true, would not just move forward from there in the face of the example we just mentioned and examples like it, but that they would go back and reconsider the premises from which they started. So my point is that Moore's proof of the external world works in the same way. Here we have two sets of claims, the skeptical hypothesis that we don't know that there's an external world, and therefore that we don't know that this is a hand. And Moore's hypothesis, that we know that this is a hand, and therefore we know there's an external world. So Moore is now in a position to claim that his premise, we know that this is a hand, is more commendable than the skeptic's premise, we don't know that there is an external world.
So you've got these two, what would you call them, theories?
Sets of claims.
Two sets of claims, and it seems that Moore's is the more convenient one, because at least you start with something there rather than coming from nothing.
Yeah.
I think it's a bit of a cop-out, to be honest, Ed, as always.
You don't think he's given enough reason for why you should suppose his is right and not t'other?
Not really. It just seems nicer, to be honest, to think. It's always nicer to believe that you actually exist.
Yeah. No, I agree that it could look like a cop-out. I particularly think that the Moore's proof of the external world and the religious example are not comparable.
I do think Moore's response is quite elegant, though. Coming at it from, you know, completely the opposite direction must have been quite a new way to look at it.
Yeah, it is ingenious. And I mean, if we had a lot more time, we'd consider other responses, and then I'd do Moore's, because you'd see sort of how clumsily people were dealing with the issue, and then Moore came in.
Well, maybe after this, we'll continue our session down the pub and thrash out some pub truths.
Some real pub truths. Anyway, I think that Moore's proof of the external world and the religious example are not comparable, which will reveal why I think that Moore's proof of the external world could look like a cop-out. So the religious example involves a moral issue, whether or not genocide is sometimes desirable, which we can all settle instinctively for ourselves. But the skeptical scenario involves an epistemological issue, whether or not we can know that there is an external world, which we cannot settle so easily. So to put things another way, we can introduce an additional ethical element to help us choose which path to take in the religious example. But what do we do when we don't have this additional ethical element and all we have to go on is what we think we know about the world? So the worry is that Moore hasn't proven the premises of his argument. He hasn't proven that he has a hand, he's just waved it about a bit. And in order to prove he has a hand, he will have to prove that he's not under the spell of a wicked demon or a brain in a vat. Or whatever. And in that sense, I think it is a cop-out, because I think Moore accepts that he can't prove he has a hand. But he argues cunningly that he can still know he has a hand anyway.
He's had a good bash at it.
He has. So I think in the end, what Moore's saying is that our fundamental beliefs about the world cannot be proven. Now, this might not look like an attractive option, but his response breaks the dilemma in epistemology between things that we believe on blind faith and things that we believe on the basis of proof. So we don't believe that we have hands for no reason. We have lots of sensory evidence. We just can't prove any of it. Now, our inability to prove our beliefs true has led to a shift in epistemology towards externalism, which is the point of view that factors that make a person's belief count as knowledge or count as truth do not originate inside their heads, but depend on the world. So the idea would be that even if you knew X, you might not know that you knew X. So
right.
With the skeptic scenario, the answer would be, yes, you know you have a hand, but you don't know that you know you have a hand. There's nowhere near enough time to go into that detail. I just thought I'd mention that for any readers that were interested. Any listeners that were interested. Reading. Exactly. So for our purposes, whether or not we are entitled to have any knowledge about the external world remains a mystery. As ingenious as Moore's response undoubtedly was, it cannot account for why the skeptical argument is so convincing, nor why it continues to worry us so much. So Moore tried to dissolve our concerns by telling us that the skeptical argument was false. But my worry is, if the argument was at all concerning in the first place, then being told from the start that its conclusion is false is not actually very helpful. And my final thought for the day is just how great The Matrix was as a film, really, and how shocking 2 and 3 were by comparison.
Don't even get me started on 2 and 3. 1 was an absolute masterpiece.
It was.
So good.
I actually, when I was preparing for this podcast, I listened to another podcast in which a guy completely slated The Matrix. He said the only redeeming feature about it was the philosophy. And I sort of wondered whether we'd watch the same film. But everyone's entitled to their
did
opinion.
Did he not see Neo bending backwards dodging bullets?
Apparently not.
Did he not watch that bit? Did he not see Trinity in a leather catsuit? Did he not watch that bit either?
I don't know. Well, we had to put these questions to him. I think I'll close with the thought that everybody is entitled to their opinion, but some people's opinions are better than others.
Excellent. So what you're telling me is that I know that I exist, but I cannot trust anything else.
That's basically what you're saying? Pretty much it, long and short of it.
I can see you grinning like a Cheshire cat. I feel like Alice just stumbled through the looking glass and just tumbling down the rabbit hole yet again.
Well, I did my best, Rob. I'm sorry I couldn't do more for you.
Anyway, I have to congratulate you on another fantastic episode.
Thank you. Thanks, Rob.
Okay, well, it's time to talk about the competition, Ed.
Competition time.
Thank you for all your interest. And it was very difficult to pick one of you out of the 56 people that took their time to write in. Ed scoured the emails.
I did. I particularly enjoyed the photos that some of our female listeners attached to their emails.
Oh, I didn't get any.
No, that surprised me.
Yeah, Ed scoured the emails. And we can announce that the lucky winner is... Mr. William Herman. Well done. He'll be joining us next time to discuss the ontological argument and the existence of a god. However, a special mention must go out to Mr. Yoshimitsu, and in answer to your question, yes, that is why they call me the Purple Dart. So, well done, Mr. Herman, and we'll look forward to seeing you in the fifth and final episode of Series 1, sadly.
It's very sad.
Anyway, as always, if you've liked the podcast, you can get in touch with us a various number of ways, either via Facebook or Twitter, at Thirst Podcast, and remember the hashtag Ed and Rob. Or you can visit our website, www.thethirstpodcast.com, and iTunes, Ed.
Nice.
Well, I remembered it that time. Well, it's taken enough times.
Well done.
Anyway, stay thirsty, everyone.
I always do. This leads Descartes to his
The story revolves around the main character called Neo.
Most stories revolve around the main character, Rob. Sorry, I couldn't handle it.
Of course it revolves around the main character. Stop. Cut.